is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Udi.
Good morning, Jill.
Well, it's wonderful to welcome Udi back to the studio, and he's going to talk about Jewish nationalism. Who has ever heard of such a thing?
Well, it's a good question, Joan. It's very fashionable today in the West and all over the world, actually, to claim there's no such thing as a Jewish nation, as a Jewish people, and it's just a myth. And what we'll try to see this week and next week is how the concept of a Jewish nation evolved from the concept of a Jewish people, from Am Israel, and where it is standing today.
Okay, start.
So the first time we hear about the people of Israel, of course, is when, Joan?
The Congress.
Not much before the Congress.
Oh, we're going back.
Back in time. We're talking biblical times, right? The first time we have a people of Israel, it's the descendants of Jacob. They come into the land of Israel after Egypt. They occupy the land and they build a homeland for their people, for the people of Israel. But actually, what happens after a few hundred years, after an exile, they come back. But after a few hundred years more, they went to another exile, and this time for 2,000 years. And there's a question whether or not they remained a Jewish people in the 2,000 years they lived scattered around the world. Was there a unity between the Jewish community in Ethiopia, the Jewish community in Russia, the Jewish community in England, and the Jewish community in China? Were they one people, or were they actually different peoples but with the same religion? And it's not an easy answer. Throughout the Middle Ages, as we know, people weren't really concerned with those questions. Most of them were concerned about what will they eat tomorrow, and how will they get rid of this landowner or that landowner. So nobody wrote too much about it. But we do know that there was a connection between the different communities. Sure, one can claim that that connection is a religious connection, but you can also see that their connection went over trade, which is not something religious. It went over language, which is again not religious. It went through marriage, which is again not something religious. And you can see that the connection between the Jewish communities and their non-Jewish surrounding wasn't usually perceived as the same people. The Jews were referred to as Jews or Hebrews or Israels or Israelis or Israelis and a million and one other names.
But always in a religious context.
Not. So that's the interesting thing. To claim somebody is Jewish is definitely religious. Mm-hmm. To claim somebody is Hebrew is not necessarily religious. To claim somebody is Israeli is also not necessarily religious in the Middle Ages. They seen it as an ethnicity, as a race. The non-Jewish world, sure, some saw it as a religion. We're generalizing here. We don't have time to go in each location throughout the Middle Ages. But in general, the Jews were not seen as a part of their surrounding. I would say 99.9% of the cases. Yes. If they have converted into Christianity, into Islam, into Hinduism, into Confucianism or Buddhism, wherever they were, then definitely they were accepted as a part of the people. But even then, from the time of the Spanish Inquisition onwards, we can see that the Jews are not always completely accepted. And some people remember that that family was Jewish even if 500 or 600 years passed.
Still seen as a minority.
Exactly. Even if they're Christians, priests, nuns, whatever they are, they can be perceived as Jews, which again shows us that there is a concept of a people. Another thing that can show us a concept of a people is the relationship to Israel. True, every religion, almost every religion, has some relationship to a geographical location, whether it's the Muslims with Mecca and Medina, whether it's the Christians with the Vatican and Jerusalem, or whether it is all sorts of other religions. But Judaism and the relationship to Israel is more goes beyond a religious connection. The connection to the land is actually a connection to a homeland, to an origin. And you can see that through letters and through religious documents, but within them, you can see intertwined nationalistic ambience, I would say. You can see poems from the Middle Ages in Spain, you mostly about yearning to Israel, yearning to the land of Israel, to the soil. True, the yearning and...
And in prayers.
Well, prayers, of course, but we're trying to see how on top of the prayers, on top of the religious part, there were more. The secular culture, if one can call rabbis that are writing poems secular culture, is also showing a huge, huge connection to a land, to a geographical location. And when people, many times throughout history, we can see it in Donna Grazia, and we can see it in with the Ari, and we can see it with all sorts of Jews throughout the Middle Ages, the late time of the Middle Ages, there's a yearning to come back to Israel. Some of them actually goes back and settle themselves in Israel. What happens in modern times is that everything changed. Because of whom?
Tell me.
As always, it is Napoleon.
He brought about the change.
He brought about everything.
Right. It's all coming back.
It's all coming, yes. Napoleon is always to be blamed in history. That's something we should always remember. In any case, so Napoleon sets loose all winds of nationalism, and Europe is in a turmoil. And to some extent, North Africa as well. We can see it in Egypt, definitely, and maybe in other locations as well. So suddenly, peoples, and one very interesting people, the Greeks, are finding out they're not only a minority, but they can also be a majority. Because you can be a minority in an empire, but you can also be a majority in a small country. And what we see all around Europe is free nations try to become free, or rather occupied nations try to become free. And we can see that all around the place, people are writing about their origins. Suddenly the Greeks remember...
Looking for the like people.
Exactly. And more, not only that, but people are also trying to see where they are coming from. 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago.
They're looking for their roots.
Exactly. Something that nobody really did, again, in generalization throughout the Middle Ages. So the Greeks are suddenly reading the Iliada, or reading Aristotle, or they're reading all sorts of Greek literature, ancient Greek literature, as something relevant to their present day. Mm. Something that didn't really happen. And it happens with other nations as well. Of course, the Greeks are a good example because they are as ancient, or almost as ancient as the Jews. Now, what happens with the Jews? The Jews...
Are bewildered.
Are bewildered.
as usual.
They don't know what to do. Because on one hand, they are a nation. On the other hand, the nation is being conceptualized as a being with a language, a religion, a common land, and sovereignty. The Jews lack a common language. They lack a common land. They lack sovereignty. The only thing they have is religion. And in modern times, I can refresh your memory, many of the Jews are also not that religious. So actually, are they a nation? And what we see is that from each side of the Jewish spectrum, in the beginning in the fringe, but slowly, slowly becomes closer to the center until it's the majority of the Jewish people, see themselves as a part of a nation, see themselves as a part of a bigger whole. Now, it's not very easy to see, because you can see that a part of modernization and because a part of those nationalistic revolutions brought the Jews emancipation and invited them to be a part of the French nation, Hungarian nation, Greek nation.
So they identify with the country in which they live.
Exactly. But they have a different religion. Yeah. And they're struggling to be welcomed in that country with their own religion. So they don't want to claim themselves as a separate nation. because that is defeating the purpose.
They'll be an alien.
Exactly. But we do see in the fringe in the beginning, as they see rabbis. In the beginning, we see rabbis, important rabbis, but not, I would say, influential in the beginning, that are writing books and letters about and essays about how the Jews should come back to the land of Israel, how the Jews should again rejoice as a free nation. We can see Rabbi Reins as a prime example for that.
And still the writers are rabbis, religious leaders, rather than the secular leaders?
So that's very interesting. In the beginning, we can definitely see that the rabbis are writing, but parallel to the rabbis, at the same time exactly, but without talking to them. Okay, people that rebelled against the rabbis are coming to the same conclusion. People like Pinhas and later like Nordo and others.
And the stirrings of Zionism.
Well, we're not Zionists yet. Zionism will come.
It's the seeds.
I would say it's the fertilizer that will come before the soil that will come preparing the seeds.
Preparing the soil, okay.
So those people were called in historiography, Chovevei Tzion, those who are fond of Zion. They're not Zionists. Mm. They're not calling everybody to move to Zion. They're not even sure they are nationalistic. Mm. But what they do know is that something is wrong, and they can fix it. As any case, we'll jump a few years ahead. Mm-hmm. The writings of those people is influencing others, but more so...
And they're writing in Hebrew?
No.
Or in the languages of the country?
Well, the rabbis, some of them are writing in Hebrew, mm-hmm. of course, but some of them are not. The others are writing in the language of the place they are living at, definitely. There will be phrases in Hebrew, a word in Hebrew here and there, but not the Hebrew yet, exactly. And we can see that the atmosphere in Eastern Europe is actually against getting the Jews emancipated. So even if the Jews were emancipated, even if they are free to do whatever they want, their neighbors still see them as Jews, or as dirty Jews even.
Apart.
Not more than apart, beneath.
Right.
Which is different than the relations in Western Europe, which... Later we'll see it's not too different, but at least in this place in time, the ambience is different. It might be anti-Semitic, but it's very polite. It's mannered. Nobody feels it. It's beneath the surface. And the Jews in Eastern Europe mostly, but all in other places as well, are trying to get themselves together as a nation. A good example for that, and to show it's not actually Zionism, will be Emmanuel Menachem Noach, a very obscure person, hugely interesting, was an American consul and was the first Jew to be an American consul, very interesting person. And he, in the 19th century, established in an island in North America a free nation for the Jews.
Yeah. On an island.
On an island. Or a half island. But it, he has a cornerstone setting, a ceremony, the papers are writing of it. You know how many Jews are coming? Not even his wife. Nobody's coming because it's, an island in North America. But this is considered to be the first example of history of a Jew in modern times trying to establish a free home for the Jews, a free nation.
In the middle of the American nation.
Well, it doesn't matter for this part. There were more than 200 places offered to the Jews to choose as a land in the modern times. Many were in North America. The concept of Zionism is only in Israel will come much later.
Much later, right.
But we can see in this point of time that more and more people are trying to see themselves as a part of a nation. Now, what does that mean? We can see cafes and salons and clubs and libraries starting to be filled with intellectuals, mostly young intellectuals, that left the yeshiva world, that are not religious, but they are seeking something. They are seeking a family. They are seeking a tribe. They are seeking a mana.
belonging.
Right? A belonging. And those people meet each other and they talk and they converse. And they start to talk in Hebrew. Or maybe to write in Hebrew. Write poems. Ask questions about the existence of the Jewish people.
They ask each other or they ask the rabbis?
They ask each other. In this place, the rabbis have no room. Some of them will be in both worlds. They will be both in the rabbinical world, meaning asking rabbis, and both in the secular world, even though a lot of them were religious, but the secular world in terms of it wasn't religious literature. And some of them will not care about the rabbis because they rebelled against the rabbis. By the way, many of those will be women, God forbid. Because the women cannot find themselves in this point of time, usually inside the rabbinic establishments. And the women are hosting it in cafes. You can see it in France. You can see it in Germany. Many of the cafes in Europe, as a side note, I will say, that we hear, you know, that stirred up revolutionary ideas were held by Jewish women. Not only the Jewish nationalistic, but the Germans, the French, some of the Italians,
the Jewesses in these countries,
yes, they are hosting those banquets. They are hosting. They are. You can see the Jewish women had a significant influence on Europe history, maybe more than they would know. They did it as a social and as a tool to make way in the society they've just came into. In any case, back to nationalism. Those people are starting to write. But once you have three Jews writing on a topic, immediately what you have?
Three different opinions.
20 different opinions. Three if they are, you know, before they got to know each other. And when you have 20 of those places, then you have a million opinions. And the question is, what are we doing? They're asking themselves again and again, what are we doing? Are we rebelling against Judaism? Are we continuing Judaism? Is it Judaism? Are we secular? Are we religious? Are we Germans? Are we French? Are we British? Are we Europeans? Are we Semitics? And so on and so on and so on and so on.
So which bit do we belong to?
Which bit do we belong to and which bit do we don't belong to? Which is sometimes more difficult.
Important.
Exactly. It's as important. Now, those people are writing, you know, you can see papers like Hatzofer and Asef and Hayal, all sorts of this very Hebraic names. Most of them will mean things like the leaves or an animal or, you know, something very romantic.
But in those days, the boys learned Hebrew, but not necessarily the girls. The girls
Definitely.
Didn't go to Hebrew school.
Yes. Well, there was no such thing as Hebrew school. Hebrew school is a very modern being. There was a cheder.
Yeah.
And definitely the girls in most countries didn't attend cheder, but they didn't know how to read and write. Not to the best level possible, but they did definitely, they were taught Hebrew to read and write. They were supposed to read the Siddur, at least, if not the Bible as well. They weren't supposed to teach it. They weren't supposed to, you know, rule. But they were definitely a part of society, unlike the Christian you would write in Europe, in the Middle East, in the Muslim or the Christian societies. Females did not know literacy. They were illiterate. In the Jewish society, you can see about 80-90% of literacy in the Middle Ages. Very, very considerably higher than the average. In any case, they're writing, they're debating. And what we see is the beginning of a culture, which is a Jewish culture, but it's not religious. It's talking about holidays. It's talking about the seasons. It might be even talking about God. But it's not a religious culture. Now, is that the first step of nationalism? Probably not. But it's a significant step because it's a very difficult task to maintain a nation when it's only bound in religion. You can see it until today, many of the struggles the Muslim world is currently going through with the Arab Spring is because there's a debate how you can maintain the nation when it's supposed to be entirely Muslim. how do you do it? How do you cope with minorities? How do you cope with women? How do you cope with seculars and so on? Once the Jewish religion, the Jewish people, the Jewish faith, the Jewish ethnicity is becoming to be a nation, it becomes more secular. De facto. It's just a part of the story.
And that has an influence on the religion too and what happens to it.
It has huge influence. Mm. Huge influence, definitely. Now, but if we'll go a step backwards. So we have all those Jews writing, debating.
Young people.
Almost all of them are young people. But that's still not a nation, because we said nation is a language, which now they have, a religion, which they always did, and a land. Which land are they supposed to be at? Are they supposed to be in the land they are at, or are they supposed to be in the land they should be going to, they should immigrate out to? And it's not cut clear. Because in Europe, until World War One, and in some extent, or even more so, until World War Two in Eastern Europe, and to some extent in Western Europe as well, minorities and national minorities are as part of society as the color white. It's just there. You cannot ignore it, and you cannot deny it, and you cannot put it in your conversation. It is the data that you have to feel, something you have to work with, to play with, if you're a leader. And when there start to be elections in those countries, you have not only the German party, but you also have the Austrian party and the Italian party and the Spanish party, all in Germany. And if you're in Switzerland, you'll have all sorts of parties. And you live in Belgium, you'll have the Dutch and the French. But you'll also have some British and maybe a German that you will came across. Mm-hmm. And in Poland, in Eastern Europe, it's even more so.
Because they were small states before the war and they only amalgamated.
Yeah, definitely. But it's more than that. People didn't have the concept of a border fenced, that you cannot pass because then you become something else until modern times. It's a very modern concept. So you would have a German village in Russia and a Russian village in Germany, and they wouldn't see it as something that's a problem. So in Poland, in the parliament, you can see, Germans as a union in the party. You can see Russians, and you can see Latvians, and you can see Slovaks, and you can see Poles as well, and Ukrainians. And what about the Jews? The Jews are also setting a party.
Now they're doing politics.
Of course, everybody are. You have to. It's a part of the game. If you want to stay relevant, as relevant as getting sewer system to your house, right? I'm not talking high aspirations. The simple stuff. You have to be in politics. Now the Jews are setting a party. And they're setting more and more parties because, of course, they cannot agree with each other. That's very problematic. But in any case, once they set a party, they are a national minority. In a conference in the 20s in San Remo, they ask for to be accepted as a national minority, the 1920s. We can see that the Jews are in Eastern Europe again more, but to some extent in Western Europe as well, are acquiring a characteristic of a national minority within the land they're sitting at. Meaning, areas that are Jewish areas will become a nationalistic characteristic for the Jews that they are at. And we can see, for example, in South America. Jews have been immigrating to South America for years before modern times. Since the discovery, the first synagogue in Brazil, in Recife, was in the 15th century.
Didn't know that.
So it's very, very old. Afterwards, they moved mostly to North America and, all the Caribbeans became pirates. Very interesting story. But in any case,
there were Jewish pirates?
Many. We should have a show only on Jewish pirates. But in any case, the Jews in South America in modern times, what are they? They're not natives. They're not exactly the Christian, conquerors. What are they? They're
traders.
Exactly. They're traders. They worship not wo- the, their religion. They talk a language, but their economy is usually among finances and trade because that's where they were drawn to.
Is that where Ladino started then?
No, Ladino is much before. Is in Spain. Ladino is from Spain, from the Golden Age in Spain. Now the Jews in South America, we can see all of a sudden Ashkenazi Jews are arriving in modern times because they are fleeing anti-Semitism in Russia, anti-Semitism in Poland, and anti-Semitism in Ukraine. And you can see all sorts of barons, Jewish barons, that are purchasing land for the Jews so they'll become farmers in South America because the Jews has to be farmers. Baron Hirsch purchased gigantic amounts of land in Argentina mostly and bring Jews from East Europe there. Jews in Brazil are doing similar things. And you can even see in other places similar things in South America. For example, many years before the time we're talking about in Suriname, there was an area that's called Joodse Savanna. Suriname is a Dutch colony. Joodse Jewish Savanna. They settled Jews in the savanna. And you can see a synagogue and so on. That wasn't really a successful story, but the point is that there were attempts like that in South America for many years. And we can see that the Jewish national movement is trying to acquire land all over the place. To be a part of the Argentinian nation as a national minority. The Jews everywhere are trying to be a national minority.
Because it's a sanctuary to get away from oppression.
Exactly. A minority has rights. The Middle Ages seized without rights. Emancipation gives you many rights, but also takes many rights. So Jews want those rights. Now, true, in Western Europe, they usually flee the idea of Jewish nationalism. They wanted to be Germans. They wanted to be British. They wanted to be Dutch. They wanted to be Frenchmen, not Jewish Frenchmen. Frenchmen that occupy the Jewish faith. But all over the world, elsewhere, Jews were part of a Jewish minority. And what we'll see next week is how being a part of a minority not only sustained them as one unity, but also helped them reorganize themselves better once Jewish nationalism became what is today, which is Zionism.
So you're saying that where they were first citizens of the country where they were living, and secondary Jewish, they didn't have the same hunger for nationalism as those who identified first as a minority rather than citizens of the country in which they were.
I don't know if it's about hunger, because we can see Herzl, for example, you know, he was in Germany, in Austria, in France, in all of those people, places, I'm sorry. So I wouldn't go that far as the statement that you've just made, but I will definitely say that the masses weren't in the West. The masses that were hunger to be a part of this Jewish nation were in the East and in the New World.
Right. Okay, so next week we will continue with the story of Jewish nationalism. And at some time we'll talk about the pirates. So thank you for listening. Don't forget to listen next Sunday, and remember, the time is 10 past 10. So you remember when? Sunday at 10 past 10. And if you've missed this program, you can go to www.planetaudio.org.nz/Radio Shalom.